Sounds good. Forget I'm not sure it could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me. Figure out, I paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice, I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right.
Was the Dixie Chicks, Not Ready. And this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, member supported. And this is Melody with Truth Quest. And I'm flying solo tonight, so I don't have my co-host, but as I have a great guest, Colonel Dan Marvin, Dangerous Dan, and he has a publisher named Trine Day and Oregon Publishing House, and he and they have defended themselves in a costly legal battle to exercise their First Amendment rights that began in federal district court in Charleston, South Carolina on October 31st, 2005. On Wednesday, November 2nd, a mistrial was declared. The plaintiff's lead attorney bizarrely disappeared from the courthouse the day before and admitted himself to a local hospital, and the trial was rescheduled for January 23, 2006. On trial was Colonel Marvin and his book, Expendable Elite, One Soldier's Journey into Covert Warfare. a Vietnam wartime story of his experience commanding an independent special forces operation in 1966 in the district of An Phu among the Wo Hao's, a militant Buddhist sect. The book was written in 1988 and published in 2003 by Trine Day. On January 30, 2006, after about just 2 hours of deliberation, the jury found Lieutenant Colonel Marvin and Trine Day innocent. Are you there, Colonel?
I am. I'm here, right here.
Oh, great.
God bless you.
Well, I guess I'll let you go ahead and finish talking about what you about yourself and how you got into writing this book.
Well, I got into Special Forces on the very day that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. That's the day that I volunteered for Green Beret training. He was a hero of mine, and even more so, a hero of my best friend, Master Sergeant Gerard V. Parmentier. And what was interesting is I volunteered from Yuma Proving Ground. I was out there testing parachutes. Got to Fort Bragg, North Carolina in January of the next year of 64. He was killed in 63. And the first month of training, I learned that it was our government who had actually killed President Kennedy. And it was part of Special Forces training, I would imagine it still is going strong, is a development of a mindset as a Green Beret that you do everything that you feel you're asked to do because you feel it is right for the flag of the United States of America. You are taught right up front that whenever there's a covert operation, that's a top secret operation, whether it be an assassination or terrorism or industrial sabotage, all these things that a Green Beret is trained for, they're all voluntarily taken on, and there's no recourse but to do it once you say, I do, I will, when you volunteer for it, and also there's no protection, so that you know, you do your best to see that you come through it on the other end safe and sound. But we were taught that right there in Special Forces training that Kennedy was killed because he was threatening the ability of the CIA and the Special Forces to do covert operations without the specific approval of the White House on each and every one. It was a fact that the CIA had independent operations going on, and that's what my book is about, is one that I commanded in An Phu, Vietnam, amongst 64,000 Buddhist Hoa Haos, which is a religious sect of the Buddhist religion. The training was absolutely excellent, and I can honestly say today, and this is some 40 years later, that the Green Beret training is without a doubt the best of all the armed forces in the world, and it probably still is. They're trained to do all kinds of interesting things, to learn how to use special explosive devices. With some of them have some strange names like the earmuff charge and the dust initiator charge, both of which I feel were used in the federal building when that was blown down. But my book is about my 7 months in An Phu, Vietnam. It's an independent operation. Colonel William Tuttle, commanding officer of all the special forces in the Delta area of Vietnam in December of 65, asked me if I would volunteer to take an independent command that was in a place called An Phu.
Before you get too far into this, when you were mentioning that you learned about JFK's assassination and why he was killed, how did that come about? I mean, explain that a little bit further.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, they taught us that on covert operations, They were always top secret operations. They were always volunteer operations. And they were unquestioned operations. Otherwise, if we were being trained as assassins, for example, and if we were asked to kill somebody for the United States government, we don't ask why. We just either accept it or deny it. You don't have to accept it. But once you accept it, you go ahead with it and get it done. As I was asked to kill Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, who actually had the photographs of the real autopsy of John F. Kennedy. But during this training, they made it clear to us that the assassination of our president, President John F. Kennedy, was accomplished by our own government. They didn't come right out and say it, but they told us, for example, there was four mafia involved as shooters in the Kennedy assassination in Dallas. And two of them are from American mafia. One was on the rooftop of the building next to the Texas Book Depository. The other one was on the grassy knoll. In fact, I know his name now, Jimmy Files. He's in Joliet Prison. I've corresponded with him regularly for a few years. And then there was two other mafia from the Corsican mafia. Now, I mean, they came out with this stuff. I didn't invent this. And they were on the two different routes going from where the hit was made in downtown Dallas to the hospital. There was two different ways that his vehicle driver could have taken the wounded president to the hospital, and there was a shooter from the Corsican Mafia along with a spotter with high-powered binoculars on each of those two routes. The man with the high-powered binoculars was to determine whether or not he felt that President Kennedy could make it to the hospital and live. If he felt that, then he would tell the shooter and President Kennedy would be hit again. Didn't have to. They assumed from what they saw through the high-powered binoculars that he'd die. During the break of one of the classes on assassinations, the two CIA instructors, and by the way, I verified by telephone call with General Yarborough, who commanded all Green Berets, who commanded the Special Warfare Center where this training was conducted, he verified that they did, in fact, have CIA, he called them advisors instead of instructors, and that they did have classes of instruction on assassination techniques that they called counter-assassination training and counter-terrorist training, but it was to teach us to do those kind of things. And during the break between two of the classes, I overheard one of the instructors say to the other, things did go pretty well in Dallas, didn't they? That's what I heard, and I assume from the request that I had on the 6th day of August, 1965, to kill Lieutenant Commander Bruce Pitcher, which I learned later that he had the movies and slides of the actual autopsy of John F. Kennedy, and that's why they wanted him killed, because he was going to retire from the Navy and then give those out to the public, so that we would know that the Warren Commission report was a big lie. And unfortunately, he had told too many people that he was going to be retiring and going to work for this broadcasting company as a broadcaster, as yourself, and he would release this information. In fact, I talked to his widow. I did not kill him, by the way. I refused it because it was in the United States, and the way that we were trained is that we, the Green Berets, would be used for those kind of things overseas. And when he asked me, the CIA agent asked me, if I'd accept that job, I assumed it was overseas. I was already on orders to go to Vietnam. And it would have simply been like this. I would have got to Vietnam, then I would have gone and take care of the job, and then got back to my unit, and then pulled back up on the rolls. But he said it was in the United States at Bethesda Naval Hospital. I told him, no, I don't do that. So I didn't do it, but he was assassinated a year later after they found, and of course the key was, as they told me, as he told me just after I had accepted the job, was to get this information that he was going to give to the enemy. Of course, the enemy was the American people, was the actual photographs of the John F. Kennedy autopsy. Now, to prove that, by the way, there's a book out called Without Smoking Gun by Kent Heiner, and he details this whole thing in there, but I actually spoke to the widow of Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, and I told her that I had been asked to kill her husband. This was years later when I found out what role he had and how he died, and she knew that he had the records of the actual autopsy of John F. Kennedy, and she was ordered. Now, this is the widow of a Navy lieutenant commander. She was ordered by Navy intelligence personnel never to talk to anybody about the death of her own husband. She had asked to have his wedding ring, and she told me this on the phone. I recorded this, by the way, and this entire conversation was given to the jury. They heard this audio tape of my two conversations with a widow of the naval officer that I was asked to kill. She said that these Navy intelligence officers had told her not to discuss his death with anybody, anytime. And this was, of course, had been 20 years before that, or 30, I forget how many years it was before that. But she told me the whole deal, and I recorded an audio tape and demanded an investigation on it, and did, in fact, get at least copies of the Navy and the local county coroner's office on the autopsy conducted on Commander Pitzer. But she had asked, by the way, of the commanding officer of Bethesda Naval Hospital for her husband's wedding ring. And they told her that his hand was too mangled to get the ring off. Of course, now, in combat, I'll tell everybody, the world should know this, that if I was killed in combat, and it was, they would actually, if they had to, cut the ring off my finger, just cut my finger off so they get that ring to send home to my wife, because that's an important thing. But I believe in my heart that in the inner band of that wedding ring, he had the directions to where the film of the JFK autopsy was actually stored. In the actual autopsy, both of them, of Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, they showed nothing had happened to his hands, either one of them. So the fact that what they told her was a big lie, just like the fact that they ruled it as a suicide, which it could not have been, but that's what they ruled it.
So did they get the evidence?
No. Oh, excuse me. You mean did those who killed him get the evidence?
Right.
I'm sure they did, because it's never been released.
Okay.
And you could actually call Dennis David and get him on your program. Although he's getting old like me, and I don't know whether he'd be want to go on a program anymore. He and I have tried to get before Congress through our senators and congressmen to try and get us to be able to testify before Congress as to the truth. But Dennis David is a retired warrant officer in the Navy. He actually stood beside William Bruce Pitzer, the man I was asked to kill, and he saw the film of the JFK autopsy, and he saw the other pictures of the JFK autopsy that were just, you know, straight pictures, not film. And he could testify, and we tried to get him before Congress to testify that the Warren Commission report was a lie because of what those autopsy photos would show.
Okay, so you can go ahead and go back to where you were getting into your story about your that's in your book.
Oh, so I volunteered. Colonel Tuttle asked me if I would volunteer to take over the independent command on ANFU And the reason it was an independent command, and the reason it was top secret and was a volunteer thing, was that that would be the only camp of all the Special Forces camps along the border that would be permitted to go against the enemy inside of Cambodia. One of the things that my book proves beyond a doubt of any kind, and we proved it in court, is that our president, President Johnson, had authorized the enemy safe havens all along the Cambodian border. In fact, I quote General William Westmoreland, who commanded all the troops, Allied and us, inside of South Vietnam. He stated in his book, A Soldier Reports, and I quote him from his book and the page number and everything, he states in there unequivocally that he was ordered not to tell Congress, and he was ordered not to tell the press about the enemy safe havens or the enemy use of the Mekong River. Now, the Mekong River is the biggest river going through Vietnam into Cambodia. The enemy was authorized to take and use ships hauling supplies to them as long as they were not marked on the manifest as war goods, as weapons or ammunition. Those ships could carry those weapons into Cambodia, and our Green Berets that were allowed to border the ship along with two South Vietnamese police officers were allowed only to look at the manifest. And this one ship that they went on that I was told about by the Green Beret that controlled the Mekong River going into Cambodia, that manifest on this Lithuanian ship said 10,000 tons of toys. Well, that captain knew that that was a lie, and he sent two Green Berets along with a platoon of Vietnamese Wahaos. He also had the Buddhist Wahaos. Wonderful fighters, brave men. And he took them up the Mekong River into Cambodia, and he watched them unload 10,000 tons, or he estimated it was 10,000 tons. That's what the manifest had said there was in toys, but they were all weapons and ammunition that they could then use against our forces firing from Cambodia, and our forces were not allowed to fire back. Now, all you have to do is ask yourself, all of you listeners, ask yourself who could tell General Westmoreland, who could order General Westmoreland that he could not tell the Congress, who could order General Westmoreland not to tell the press. It had to have been the White House. There could be no other person order the senior commander not to tell Congress about something where we were aiding the enemy. And that's why they took my book to court. Chris Milligan, and there's a brave man and a good loyal man, a publisher, when I got the deputy sheriff delivered the summons to me to report on October 31st to court in federal court in Charleston, South Carolina, Chris Milligan was named on there also, and I sat right where I'm talking to you on the same phone, and we're on a conference call, and Barry Bachrach, our brave attorney, he told Chris Milligan, he says, Chris, you do not have to be involved in this. We can just pull you from this because the colonel has protected you 100% by keeping maintaining the copyright on every word that's in that book, and all you did was publish it. And he refused to get off the lawsuit. He wanted to, the way he put it was that he trusted me, and he felt that book was all the truth, or he would not have published it, and he wanted to stick by his authors. So he and I, together, got ourselves in $152,000 worth of debt to prove to the world, through victory in court, that that book is true. And folks, you out there who have not read Expendable Elite and do not know for a fact in a book that's proven in federal court to be true that our president, our White House, as corroborated by General Westmoreland, allowed the enemy to have safe havens all along the Cambodian border. Personally, I think, you know, I lost my four best friends in Vietnam, all Green Berets. And I assume out of 58,000 Americans that were killed in Vietnam, and I think about a million South Vietnamese, that 90-some percent of those should not have been killed if we'd been allowed to win that war and the enemy had not been given their freedom to have sanctuaries all along that border.
Well, why do you think that they were ordered not to, why they were aiding the enemy?
I believe in my heart now, I can't prove this, but you know, those same ships that were going up the Mekong carrying war goods to the enemy in Cambodia were coming back from there, and people, a friend of mine in the CIA, and I can't release his name. I mean, he'd be dead if I released his name. He told me flat out that those same ships were hauling drugs and drug paraphernalia out to the back to the United States for distribution in the United States. It was the biggest CIA drug running operation going on. And basically, I believe that with all my heart, because what reason would the President of the United States have in helping the enemy? And why are they still doing it? You know, I talked about 4 months ago, I sat with a Marine Lieutenant Colonel who had just got back from Iraq, and I had a friend with me, a man named Donald Kruger, because I wanted to have a corroboration on what this Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel told me. And I asked him, I said, when you were over there and you were fighting the enemy in Iraq and you were to chase them into the village or the city, they would probably go to a, and he answered, mosque. And I said, now, if they started shooting at you from that mosque, these are United States Marines, could you fire back at the enemy? And he said, absolutely not. Now, this was 4 months ago. We're still not allowed to fire at the enemy. They had sanctuaries in Iraq the same as they had sanctuaries in Cambodia. That's the kind of government that we've got going. I've submitted proof to all of this, to the White House, to senators, congressmen, to the superintendent of West Point, the commander of Special Operations Command, the commanding general of the Commanding General Staff College, of the Army War College. None of them will do anything about it, and all I can figure is it's fear of the CIA. And, of course, the CIA used the mafia or people like myself to do all their silencing of those they want silenced. In fact, I sat, and you'd be interested in this, Melody, as your listeners would be. In 1964, a Master Sergeant Joe Hill and I went to Natick, Massachusetts to do some final top-secret testing of Special Forces equipment. While we were there, we stayed in the Holiday Inn, which is right next to the the test center, Natick Laboratories, and Frank Sinatra happened to be singing at that time. And, of course, we always figured wherever Frank Sinatra was, the mafia would be there. Well, sure enough, it turned out they were. Joe Hill and I were in uniform with a Green Berets on the table. He was a master sergeant. I was a captain in Special Forces. And we were drinking. I drank in those days. I haven't since 89. But I used to drink a lot of vodka. And all of a sudden, we're sitting there, and free drinks started coming into us. And I asked the waiter twice, nicely, you know, where are these drinks coming from? And he said, I can't tell you. So the third time he came around, I grabbed hold of his arm, and I told him, look, I'm going to break your arm unless you tell me where these drinks are coming from. He would have found out why I'm called Dangerous Dan, I reckon. But so He told us that he just had never before seen a captain and a sergeant sit and seem like they're enjoying each other's company. And I told him, well, we're Green Berets. I said, Green Berets, you work as a team. And so if we were digging a crapper out in the boonies, we'd take turns digging that. But he would never lose track of the fact that I was the captain and I was in charge. That's the way the Green Berets operate. So we sat down. He invited us to sit at his table, so we did, and we listened to Frank Sinatra. And we came back two more times after that in the evening, met him there. And the third time, he asked us if we would come, and his father wanted us to come and have a steak supper with him at their home. Well, it turned out that his father was the Don of the Boston area mafia. And we went to his house, had filet mignon, all served with the men that were serving him and his family and us in the house. In fact, Joe Hill, I think, fell in love with the Don's daughter. But anyway, to make a long story not quite so long, we enjoyed the meal, and we sat down after the meal and sat on a sofa. And in front of the sofa was a coffee table, and on that coffee table was a beautiful inlaid box. And we were talking with the Don about different things, and he asked if we would like to work for him, otherwise get out of the Army and work for him as a hit team, because he knew we were trained as assassins by the Special Forces. And he said that he'd give us $40,000 a year as a team. Now, this is in 64. $40,000 was one heck of a lot of money. And $10,000 for every time that we did him a favor, otherwise silence somebody. And I told him, I said, look, I've got a wife and three daughters. I can't be doing something like this. I said, I do it for the CIA, you know, for Special Forces, but that's different. I said, he said, well, I'll guarantee that you won't have to kill a cop or an Army person. And we refused, because we had a good role in the United States Army as it was. And in fact, he took a dagger out and stuck each one of us in the hand. I still got my scar to show anybody. And we shook hands, and with the blood touching, and swore that we'd never give the other's name as long as the other was alive. And I talked to him about what he did for the Army as the head of the mafia, and he told us I said, were you asked to get in on the Kennedy hit? It was so funny, because he looked at us and he says, the company called me, the company, that's the CIA, says, the company called me and asked me if I'd take care of them here in Massachusetts, and I told him, look, we don't have no problems with the Kennedys in Massachusetts. That's exactly what he said. And that will be in a book one of these days called The Devious Elite, if it ever gets published. And so he told me, one thing that I did, I sent a company of men. He, by the way, he owned the largest construction company on the East Coast. And the CIA used him and his company, the Perini Construction Company, to go to Egypt, where the Russians were building the Aswan High Dam, and they were to go and help build the hydroelectric plant. But the reason why they were asked to go there by the CIA, when we had absolutely no diplomatic relations with Egypt, in fact, they were more or less our enemy, because Russia was building the dam, not us, but they asked him to send his people over there and send a copy of the plans for the hydroelectric plant to the Special Forces at Fort Bragg. I just happened to be the first commander of a Special Forces portable atomic bomb team, and those plans were to give me a specific location where I would put this atomic bomb, which was a 10-kiloton bomb that would destroy the hydroelectric plant if we were asked to do it. I was never asked to do it. And that's what I was trained for, but that's how our government was using the CIA and other than assassination.
So you're saying that that portable atomic bomb has been used for a long time then?
Yep. In fact, it's interesting. Out of 10,000 approximate retired and active duty Green Berets, there's only one other that has volunteered to go to Congress with me. Now, Dennis David was a Navy man. But Master Sergeant Jerry Wilsey, who's from Syracuse, about 20 miles from where I'm sitting right now, volunteered to go to Congress with me to prove that there was a portable atomic bomb, because he was on that same team that I commanded, only he was on it 2 years later. They had the same contingency mission in 66, and actually I was in Vietnam at that time, but they had the same contingency mission to go into the hydroelectric plant of the Aswan High Dam. The only difference was that where we had ours was a suicide mission. We had a 15-minute delay fuse on that atomic bomb. Actually, the scientists who developed it came and taught us how the whole thing came about. It was actually the trigger for the hydrogen bomb. But he thought it'd be a good idea to use it as a portable bomb that two men could carry in. I carried the bomb itself, was 95 pounds, and my executive officer carried the trigger, which was another 35 pounds. And then we had six more men on the team, radio operators and weapons people, so that we could get the job done when we're in there. But he said the timer is from a Sears Roebuck washing machine for an atomic bomb, 15 minutes. Well, Jerry Wilsey was willing to go before Congress with me and explain that when he was on the team, they had the same contingency mission, but that the timer had been improved to a two-hour timer. Now, the reason it was a very short timer when they first developed it was that they didn't want to set a timer that was give enough time for the enemy to discover and neutralize the bomb.
So the person that would have been doing that mission would have died.
Well, unless, what we did, we planned, of course, we had topographic maps of the whole area, and we knew where we would run to, and we'd pre-dig a little cave into the side of the mountain, and we would just go lickety-split from where we put that bomb and try and make it to that cave in those 15 minutes. Whether or not we could have made it, I don't know. But we just, we figured we were Green Berets, we could do anything.
So you'd never detonated one then?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think the United States ever has. But it's interesting because I wrote when the 9/11 came, the big terrorist thing,
mm-hmm.
I wrote to the president and to Governor Tom Ridge, and I warned them about the possible use of these atomic bombs to, for example, blow the George Washington Bridge. They could just use that on just one set of those cables going up, and then the bridge would twist and just fall apart, more or less. And I never did even get a response from them. The only response I got was from the New York State Police. I copied them on it, and they were still waiting for advice from the White House through Governor Ridge's office there. That to me, that was a very serious threat. And they were actually, when we used them, they were stored at Seneca Army Depot, about 40 miles from, or 50 miles from here, and that's where they brought them down when they trained us on the use of the atomic bomb.
How long do you think they'd been around by the time that you had been introduced to them?
Brand new. I commanded the very first team to use them.
And so,
1964.
Oh, okay.
The Russians came out with one, but I think that was a little bit later. I've got a picture of theirs also. I've got a picture of ours. But Congress is not interested in that either. And Jerry Wilsey and I have both volunteered to go before Congress, and I had all the proof that I needed about the use of that portable atomic bomb, the contingency mission, even a verbatim testimony by the Don of the Boston area mafia that he had been asked by the CIA to get those plans for the hydroelectric plant.
Okay, so go ahead and get into, you know, you'd started into the story in Vietnam with your...
Right, well, when Colonel Colonel Tuttle asked me if I'd accept that mission, I said, certainly. And he said, well, you got to understand a few things. Number one, when you go into Cambodia, it's top secret. And you will get absolutely no support from our side, no artillery support, no medevac support, no support of any kind inside Cambodia, helicopters, anything, because it's not supposed to be happening. It's a top-secret operation. And he said, if you're caught inside of Cambodia, we'll drop you or your men, whoever's caught, will be dropped from the rolls as deserters from the United States Army. Now, these are the kind of things that you were taught in Green Beret training, that when you're asked to do a secret, top-secret operation like this, you're a volunteer, you're all on your own. If you get caught, you have to suffer it. And it's something you never talk about later on with very close specifics. For example, I would never tell you that I was asked to kill a certain person and I did it, because there is no, and they explain this to us very carefully, there is no statute of limitations on murder. And any time that we were asked to assassinate somebody for our government, would have been murder, because we could never prove that we've been asked to do it. So I accepted the mission, and I went into An Phu, and I met Major Foy Van Lee, the bravest man I ever met in my life, one of the finest officers. He was a ARVN, Army of the Republic of Vietnam, Green Beret. He'd been fighting for 18 years against the communists. And the Wahao people loved him, and he loved them, and he just he was the kind of man that any man would like to fight alongside or under or over or whatever. He was a really great man, and he had actually gone. This is how gutsy he was. He went to the Minister of Defense, who later, within a month of my getting there, he took me and introduced me to him in Saigon. But he went to the Minister of Defense, and he demanded the right to fire against the enemy inside of Cambodia, or he would actually take the Wahaos out from under the control of the South Vietnamese government. And they were the best fighters there were along the border. So he got permission from the Minister of Defense, in coordination with the CIA, to be the only 30 miles of that border that the enemy would have no sanctuaries on the other side. The only problem was, Melody, when I set up the plans to invade and to kick them completely out of Vietnam, plus inside Cambodia, I made it a point to work with Major Foy Van Lee so that we would never try and push them any farther than 3 kilometers back from the border, because we could get ourselves in serious trouble if we got a mile inside the border or 2 miles inside the border and we've got no support. We've got no artillery support, no air support, and no medevac support. So I would have been putting my men at too great a risk. So what we did is we pushed them back 3 kilometers on the other side into Cambodia, and that way with our agents, and all of the agents that we had, by the way, in Cambodia were female agents, very brave women, I'll tell you. We would have known the minute they tried to move up closer to the border to attack us, and that's exactly what our intelligence agents did. We only lost one of those intelligence agents, which was too many. But that way we would know when they actually came to attack us. We had many battles with the Viet Cong coming across that border, and then we pushed them back inside Cambodia, and they always outnumbered our forces by at least 4-1, but we never, ever lost the battle. They did come in and take a little bit of territory for a very short period of time, and then when Major Foy and I led a reaction force up, we pushed them back into Cambodia. And we were very careful, Melody, while we were there, not to hurt Cambodian civilians. To me, that was extremely important because we were not at war with the Cambodians. And the fact that our president forced, really literally forced, Prince Sihanouk to allow the Vietnamese communists to have sanctuaries inside of his country, that very fact made us very careful not to hurt the Cambodian civilians. In 7 months of firing into Cambodia against the enemy, the Viet Cong, we killed over 500 enemy, wounded a lot more than that, of course, destroyed a complete complex, a headquarters complex of theirs. It includes a hospital, a training grounds, and everything else, an ammunition dump. We blew it all up and did all that inside Cambodia, and in those 7 months, we never killed or wounded one Cambodian civilian. Well, about, I went in there in December, day after Christmas of 1965, and in June of 1966, CIA agent Walter McKim, and I name him specifically in the book, which, of course, I mean, you know all the big trouble that you can get into if you name CIA operative. In fact, this is kind of neat if I may divert to the trial for a minute.
Okay,
Melody?
Uh-huh, it's fine.
Their lead attorney asked me in front of the jury when I was on the stand, he says, "You mean to tell me that you wrote that book, The Expendable Elite, hoping the CIA would sue you?" And I said, "That's correct, sir." And he said, "Why would you do that?" And I said, "Well, the CIA could only sue me for two reasons. One would be that I named their operative, Walter McKim, in the book, and that I told of top-secret operations, like the operation to kill Sihanouk." And I said, "They're all very clearly laid out in that book, and you'll see this when you get the book, as top secret in all caps. So everything that happened over there is in that book, and in order to sue me, they'd have to admit that that was the truth, because how could they put an action against me in court for naming Walter McKim unless Walter McKim was the agent? How could they accuse me of laying out information on top-secret operations, spelling it out in detail, unless there were top-secret operations?" So that's why the CIA, through the special forces, intimidated my own men. And they were the actual plaintiffs in the court action against Chris Milligan and myself. And interestingly enough, in 1988, now the court action was in 2006, actually started in 2005, and I'm glad you mentioned about their leader, the head attorney, feigning to have a heart attack. But anyway, this was in 2005 that the actual court action took place, and I forget what I was trying to get to right then and there. It's a complicated story.
Yeah.
There's a lot involved in it. Oh, I know what it is. I told him that it would have been worth 2 or 3 years in prison for me to know that the American people would finally know the truth. CIA couldn't do it, so they intimidated my men, and they're the ones who actually sued me. But in 1988, and this was what I was getting to, I'd gone out to these same men and sent them a draft manuscript in 1988, and they sent me back audio tapes and letters with things that they thought should be added in the book. In fact, my executive officer pointed out, and I'd forgot all about it, that I saved his life during one of the enemy actions. So all that's in the book. And we played those audio tapes to the jury. So here these guys were suing us in court, and in in their audio tapes, they're telling about how great the book was and wanting me to add these things to the book, and they were all added. And so that's what was presented to the jury, was the truth. I took four boxes of documentation with me to the trial. They had no documentation. And it's interesting. Chris Milligan, my publisher, and myself, to the best of my knowledge, are the very first ones ever to show up in court against the Special Operations people, the Special Forces Association. And the impact, I think, of that is what bothered them more than anything, because they assumed that we wouldn't show up. In fact, on October the 31st, the first day in court, the lead attorney, the same one who had been representing Special Forces for 20-some years, the same one who feigned a heart attack at the hospital so we'd have to cancel the court out and come back again, and he didn't think we could afford to, but that same person turned to his son, who was also one of the team of attorneys, and he said this. He says, "I didn't think Marvin would show up." Well, I happened to overhear him say that. And I went from my side of the courtroom over to him, and I've got my nose about a half inch away from his nose, and I told him, I said, "You know, the thing that you forgot was that I used to be one of you, and I was the biggest, baddest one of you." And I just turned around and walked back over to my side of the court, and he never said anything again about not thinking I'd show up. So that's what happened.
So you're not worried about repercussions for you doing this?
Well, I'll tell you, it was in 1984 that my daughter led me to the Lord Jesus Christ. And actually, in the front of a U-Haul truck down in the panhandle of Florida, that was the very day, the 29th day of January, 1984, that I started to write this book. Before that, I'd thought in my mind about doing it as fiction based on fact because of my fear of them being the CIA, sending somebody like me being a trained assassin, to kill me, to silence me for wanting to come out with the truth. And this is why I don't have many volunteers coming out with the truth about things of this nature. But the day that I got saved is the day I started mentally putting together this book. In 1988, 4 years later, I put together the first manuscript. And when you read my book, you'll see where I decided after Colonel Tuttle briefed me and asked me if I'd volunteer and then told me we'd have no backup support, no artillery, air, or medevac, I decided to keep track of everything that was going on in my command. I wrote everything down on 3x5 cards, and I sent these cards and copies of all the secret documents to a friend of mine in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, through the Vietnamese mail channels, otherwise international mail, in sealed envelopes, and he was not allowed to unseal any of those, and he was to retain all those sealed envelopes. And the only time he would actually use them is if he learned that I'd been killed over there. Then he'd give them to an attorney that we both trusted to take action against the military for killing old Dangerous Dan. Well, I sent all these 3x5 cards to him, and then when I decided that I no longer feared the CIA, I no longer feared Special Forces sending somebody to kill me, I feared only the Lord Jesus Christ, I sent away to my friend in Fort Bragg, got all those 3x5 cards and all those documents, some of which I had in court so the jury could see them, monthly operational summaries, special action reports, and things of that nature, plus the information that had been on those cards was all in the book. So that's how I was able to put together that manuscript. In 1988, I sent the draft manuscript to some of the same men who faced me in court as plaintiffs, namely John Strait, who is my executive officer, and he sent me a total of 2 tapes that were just beautiful with all kinds of things in there to add in the book, to include his own statement that he remembered the regiment that the CIA had sent to wipe us out. And, of course, that was a very crucial item in the court because the CIA didn't want the American people knowing that they'd send an Arvin regiment to kill Americans. And it was General Kong Van Dang who turned the regiment back. He was the commanding general of 4th Corps. But those are the kind of things that went into that manuscript then, was everything they sent me, and we played those tapes, showed copies of the letters from General Dang and from Major Foy Van Lee to the jury. So they had all the truth shown to them in that courtroom, and they unanimously declared us not guilty of any infractions of law with that book.
That's the hard part I have a hard time following, is how you're not guilty of any infractions.
Right. Well, we were accused of the book causing them, libel problems.
Okay.
That it was against their character assassination of those men. But it was so funny because Barry Bacharach, the attorney, he was fantastic, he and Chris Ojiba. But he asked each one of them as they got up and stand, well, what happened to you after friends of yours read the book? And they said, oh, they thought we were heroes. Well, they're shown to be heroes in the book, which is what they were. And here they are suing us for causing problems with character assassination in the book, and they're telling the jury right up front that the problem was that the book showed them as heroes and they didn't think they were. I know that's hard to figure out, but you can, by the way, anybody that's listening can go to my website, expendableelite.com, expendableelite.com. They can see a lot of what we provided the jury to include. They can actually read the entire transcript for the trial, all 5 days of the actual trial, from the 20th to the 25th of November, January of 2006. We bought the transcript. Cost us $2,500 just to get that, but that's from the court recorder, and every word that was spoken in that trial is in that transcript that any of you that are listening can go listen to or read yourself.
We
were honest, and that's why the jury, that's why the man who wrote this article put not guilty, and that was his words, and basically it was. We were not guilty of causing any problems in a libel lawsuit, $700,000 lawsuit for liability.
Let me do a station break here for
our
station identification. Whatever. It's KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my guest is Colonel Dan Marvin, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and it is 10 o'clock. So go ahead, Dan.
Well, you said you had some questions to ask, because that kind of brings everybody up to date. We won at the trial, and now we're trying to pay off our attorneys. If anybody, by the way, would like to order a book, they can call 1-800-556-2012. That's 1-800-556-2012. And when they order the book, they can order it to be a signed copy. And what happens then, Chris Milligan, his people, you can get it from Amazon and from Barnes & Noble also, but none of them will be signed. But you call my publisher, which is that number I just gave you, and tell him you'd like to have a signed copy. And what he does then, he sends the invoice to me. And I send the book right out from here to you, the listener, with your name right in there, and I sign the book. And I also include in there a copy of the very first article that came out by Tim Bates on the 15th day of February of 2006, and the title of that article is Lieutenant Colonel Marvin Not Guilty. But it tells a lot about the trial. There's a lot of other articles that were written, and most of them are in the new book, the Victory Edition, which is what you get. This one was not in the Victory Edition, so I like to send it to everybody I send a signed book to. But that's the way you can get a book, and then you'll have the truth in front of you, and you'll be absolutely amazed at the fact that our government actually aided the enemy. You'll be amazed at the fact that our government actually sent a regiment to kill me and my men. There are about 9 Green Berets and Vietnamese Green Berets, plus 400 South Vietnamese Buddhist Wahaos that worked for us, fought for us. And
why did they want to send those men to?
Because I'd kicked the CIA out of my camp. Oh, I forgot to tell you about that.
Yeah, that's what.
The CIA agent Walter McKim came to my camp and asked me if I would volunteer to set up an operation inside of Cambodia to kill Prince Sihanouk on his annual trip that he took to a certain temple. We were the closest Green Beret camp to where he could be intercepted and ambushed on the road and killed. And besides that, we had the best combat record up till that day anyway. We had some tremendous fighting forces in the Buddhist Wahaos. So he asked me if I'd set that up, and I told him I'd discuss it with Major Foy Van Lee, and I told him that I would need topographic maps and all kinds of information from him, which he brought back the next time he came, and Major Foy and I both met with him in the command bunker, and we accepted the job and to kill Sihanouk, to ambush him inside of Cambodia. And we started training the men, and one of the things that we had to do was to make sure that it looked like the communist had killed Prince Sihanouk. So all of the 42-man force that we trained to go in there and ambush and kill him were all dressed as if they were communist VC.
Why did they want to kill him?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
Good question. In fact, they asked that in court. They wanted to kill him, wanted us to kill him and make it look like it was a communist so it would turn the Cambodian people against the communists.
Okay.
And that way they wouldn't have any problems with us. It'd be problems with the communists, and then they'd join us in fighting the communists out of their country. So I asked for volunteers. We got 102 volunteers from the Buddhist Wahaos.
Why did they fight with you, the Buddhists?
Well, we went in there to help them. It was their area.
Okay.
64,000 Buddhist Wahaos and 200 Malaysian Polynesian Choms. That was the total population of our area, 30 miles of border. The Wahaos, wait till you read the book. They are the most wonderful people. 64,000 Wahaos, not one car.
Hmm.
Maybe 5 bicycles. They were farmers and fishermen, and that's all they wanted to do. They didn't want anybody to bother them. They wouldn't bother anybody else. They just wanted to have their land and their little houses and the river and the farmland, and they raised hogs. In fact, we were the very first ones to bring corn to South Vietnam, which turned out to be very valuable for them. In fact, we had 250 farmers signed up for corn to be used for seed the next year, because it's the best thing in the world for hogs to fatten them up. And anyway, so we were there to help them defend that area. I told you that Major Foy went to the to Saigon and got permission to go against the enemy inside of Cambodia. But they needed to have CIA backing on it because the CIA was running the war over there. And that's where I got involved when they asked me if I would volunteer to run the independent command working with Major Foy Van Lee, and we would actually lead the South Vietnamese Buddhist Hoa House against the enemy Viet Cong. So that's how that was involved.
Okay, and so they, and so then our government was wanting you guys assassinated.
Right.
Okay.
So we got the volunteers, and the only thing I did is I gave, and this was the important thing, I gave CIA agent Walter McKim a quid pro quo, and this was in the book. I told him that we would accept the mission, we would train the people, and we would be ready to go, but I had to have a report from my man at Fort Bragg that he had heard the President of the United States and had read in the New York Times that our President of the United States had told the American people that there would be no more safe havens for the enemy in Cambodia, and there would be no more use of the Mekong River as their main supply route. Well, 2 days before the ambush was to take place, the CIA agent came back to the camp to see how things were going on getting it all set up, but he refused to even answer my question about the quid pro quo because I told him I had not heard anything from my friend at Fort Bragg. And so he refused to answer it, so I kicked him. I unilaterally, on my own, aborted the mission to kill Prince Sihanouk. Well, that obviously was a big thing for the CIA to do that, or they wouldn't have come and asked for volunteers. So I had him order his Air America chopper back into camp and take off, take him out of there, and never to return. And he told me, he turned as Lieutenant Strait was leading him to his little white Air America chopper. He turned to me and he says, "You can't fight the company or the system because you can't win." Well, within 6 days, there was a regiment. Our intelligence agents told us of an Arvin regiment that was on the way with specific orders to wipe out our camp. Major Foy Van Lee then sent a messenger down the Basak River to meet with the chairman of the Wahao Central Committee in Wahao Village, and he asked him to go and meet with General Quang Van Dang, who had a great high regard for the Wahaos. He'd been there, as a matter of fact, not too long before that to award medals to some of our heroes. And he went to General Dang and he told him what was happening about that regiment going to wipe out An Phu, and there'd probably be 400 South Vietnamese at least killed. So General Dang picked up his phone. He called Premier Ky, the president of Vietnam, and he told him he was taking over the situation. Of course, we know, as Americans, that Premier Ky was involved in that decision on Prince Sihanouk because he worked very closely with the CIA. So he told Premier Ky that he was taking over the situation, that he was not going to allow brothers to be killing brothers. And he grabbed a hold of his senior American advisor, Colonel William Desabri, and went in Colonel Desabri's helicopter, because he had the American, the modern ones, flew over that regiment, and Colonel Desabri himself called down to the American advisors that were with that Arvin regiment, and he asked them, "Why are you attacking An Phu, or on the way to attack An Phu?" They were about 10 minutes away from going into our area on the river, the Basak River. They were all on ships and landing craft utilities, I guess you call them. And he asked them why they were attacking An Phu, and the American advisor, captain I guess it was, called up back to Colonel Desabri and said, "Because there's a renegade captain named Marvin who's leading the Wahao people against the central government." That's how they twisted that thing around. So General Dang, as soon as he got that word from Colonel Desabree, then he ordered that regimental commander, the general, to turn that regiment around and report back to his own barracks area in near Can Tho, Vietnam. And he being General Dang and Colonel Tuttle, and Colonel Desabree, flew into my camp with their helicopters. They had a whole fleet of helicopters. And just he and the colonel landed, and I formed all the troops up, and he personally gave us amnesty against any bad treatment because of what happened there. That's how we were rescued from the CIA. That's what they didn't want the American people to know.
Okay, now isn't that the person that also you helped out and moved over here?
Yes, General. Okay. As soon as he rescued us from the CIA, then he got in serious trouble with the CIA. They tried to destroy him in Vietnam, and in fact, they demanded of the central government that he be removed as the 4th Corps commanding general. And he was, but by then Premier Thieu was a new premier, and so he had General Dang leave the 4th Corps but come up and be his personal assistant for military affairs. So as the assistant to President Thieu for the military operations, he was able to work with President Thieu in Saigon to do the best they could on the war. But he, in fact, flew out on a helicopter, one of the very last helicopters to fly anybody out of Vietnam, South Vietnam, when the North Vietnamese took it over. But a very courageous man. And he came back to the United States, and somehow it was arranged so he ended up in Canada. And there he had so many threats against his life and everything that he worked for, I don't know how many years, can't take it right off my mind right now, as a janitor, as a dishwasher under an assumed name. This is the man that was the second most powerful man in Vietnam, working as a dishwasher in Canada. And a friend of mine went up to, when I finally found out he was there, a friend of mine went up to Ottawa, Canada, and asked why he was being kept in Canada. And she talked to the lady who maintained the records up there in Ottawa. And the lady that maintained the records thought that my friend was from the American Embassy. So here she is telling her that, well, there's a whole drawer full of records of things that General Dang has, illegal things that General Dang has been accused of by the American government, nobody else. But she says, oddly enough, she says there's no proof on any of it. Well, that's what I needed to know. So she told me this, and then General Dang got on the phone with me, and we talked, and I told him that I'd do what I could to get him in the country as soon as possible. And I wrote letters to the State Department and to the Justice Department for 11 months and never got so much as a response, except one response that they received my letter, but that was it. So 11 months went by, and I finally got fed up with the whole system, so I wrote President George Herbert Walker Bush a letter. And this was all told in court, by the way. And George, I wrote him a letter, and I said basically in so many words, and a copy of the letter went to the jury, that I would not give up in my struggle to get General Dang cleared of all the erroneous charges that have been levied against him by our government until either I died or the Lord returned and took me up, whichever came first. And then I slipped inside that letter a piece of pink paper about 3 inches by 3 inches, and I hand wrote on that piece of paper pen and ink, I am intimately familiar with your role in the CIA prior to your admitting it publicly. Because I knew all about how his ships were involved with the CIA, how his bank was involved with illegal CIA, banks were involved with CIA operations. I knew a lot about what he had actually done from my contacts within and his own personal experience within the CIA and Special Forces. And within 2 weeks, now I'd waited 11 months without as much as a response. Within 2 weeks, there was a complete investigation across the entire U.S. government. General Dang was cleared of all charges. He was given what they call a permanent entry visa, which means he can never be sent back out of this country, which was really important because we had proof from Vietnam that if he had been deported to Vietnam by Canada, which they wanted to do, that he would have been killed immediately on landing in Vietnam. But we got him that permanent entry visa, and I actually went up and brought him back across the border into this country. And in that permanent visa that he got was also the fact that that all those charges, of course, had been dropped. But they refused to actually give him a copy of the clearance. The only thing we had, and I showed this to the jury, I had a personal email from the State Department quoting my letter of 17 July, I believe it was, 1989, to the President of the United States. A copy of that letter, that was actually referred to by the State Department that told me that the investigation had been completed and that he'd been issued a permanent entry visa. But they kept everything so secret, and they still, to this very day, have refused to publicly declare that he was not guilty of anything.
So he really was, I mean, because I wasn't clear that those were trumped-up charges?
All of them were trumped-up charges.
Okay.
General Westmoreland, believe it or not, had even accused Mrs. Dang of running a chain of houses of ill repute up and down the coast of Vietnam, and that the general had taken millions of dollars from the Vietnamese government. And yet when I went up to Canada to bring him across the border, and remind me, if you would, in a few minutes about what happened just before that. But when I went up to bring him back, we rented a U-Haul it truck inside of Canada, the smallest one they had, 14-foot U-Haul it. Everything that he owned wouldn't even cover the bottom of that truck. And he only had two pieces of furniture, one chair and a file cabinet. We got down to the border, and interestingly enough, let me back up a little bit. The day before I was supposed to go up and bring him back across the border into the United States, I got a call from this friend of mine in the Central Intelligence Agency, and he said, "Dan, be careful because they've planned an ambush to kill you and Dang as soon as he gets in this country." So I called a friend of mine in the New York State Police, got volunteers to set up a counter ambush to make sure that the vehicle that I was driving was protected from ambush. And I called Congressman Matthew McHugh, and I said, "Matt, you got to do something." I said, "There's going to be a lot of blood on the border unless somebody takes some action." And I explained to him exactly what had happened without naming any names except for General Dang's. And within an hour, Congressman McHugh called me, and he said, "Dan," he says, "I can assure you that the safest place in the world for General Dang will be to be with you coming across that border." Just to show how true that was, I picked him up, and we came down to the border, and starting about 2 miles north of the border with the United States, every car and truck had been pulled over to either side of the road. When we got into the checkpoint, there wasn't one single person in there other than the border officials. They didn't even look in the U-Haul truck to inspect what we'd brought back and brought into the United States. The only thing they did was collect this attaché case or whatever that the general had been given by the American embassy to turn in at the border, which was locked and everything, sealed. And when they, it took them 20 minutes to get good fingerprints because the general, and I can understand why, he was so afraid that his hands were cold and sweaty and they couldn't get good fingerprints. He'd have to keep going into the men's room there at the checkpoint, getting running warm water over his hands, drying them off, and then coming back. And finally, the fourth time, he was able to get fingerprints, and then we left. And the entire border had been closed from the south, too. And inside of the United States, there were trucks and cars on either side of the road. But they opened it up as soon as we got out of there.
You didn't know what was in that briefcase, and he didn't either?
Well, I assume it's documents from the American embassy in there that related to him being cleared and everything.
Okay.
But we don't know what was in there, no.
Okay.
And if we would have broken the seal on that, then I never would have got dang into our country.
And so is he still alive? Or?
Oh, yeah, he's out in California. He and his wife, they're both American citizens. And Major Foy Van Lee is in Wichita, Kansas, with his four children, and I think some other relatives now. I mean, they're old. They're not in good shape. They're as old as I am, and that's really old for a Vietnamese. But they're all American citizens now. In fact, that's a story in and of itself, if you'd like me to tell, about Major Foy Van Lee getting him into this country. He served 13 years in the North in a Vietnamese prison, primarily because he and I had worked together, and, of course, we had been victorious in all our fights against the VC. Ours was the most secure area in all of Vietnam when I left that camp, pulled my special forces team out of there. But he had written, after he got out of prison, and this was 13 years, so it would have been in 1986, he had written to me to both through Army channels and through the State Department channels. I never got either letter. And after I'd found General Dang and got him into this country, I started in earnest trying to find Major Foy Van Lee. And I couldn't get any contacts or anything else. So finally I called the man that was the former ambassador of Vietnam to the United States, Ambassador Bui Zim, who was actually operating near Langley, Virginia. And I told him that I was trying to find Major Lee, and Ambassador Zim knew about the Wahaos and how good they were. And everything. He says, well, the Wahaos have got Central Committee is now located in the United States, in California. And he gave me the telephone number for the Central Committee. Now, here's how the Lord works in all this stuff. I called that number within 10 minutes after hanging up from talking with Ambassador Zim. And the man who answered the phone, I told him that I was looking to find Major Foy Van Lee. And he said, well, wait just a minute. He said, his nephew is standing right next to me. So his nephew got on the phone, and he told me about his father being in the prison for 13 years and then writing me through those two channels because he told his nephew that I was the only American he felt he could trust. So right away, I took and got the information that his nephew had given to me, and I gave that information to Alicia Cooper of the International Rescue Committee in California, who had helped me get a number of South Vietnamese families into this country. So she started taking action to get Major Foy Van Lee into this country. And just about a few months down the road from that, all of a sudden I get a call. And she said, Dan, I got to tell you that Henry Kissinger has ordered. Now, Henry Kissinger happened to be a board member of the International Rescue Committee. He's involved in a lot of very bad things, I think, or in a bad way in some good things, which is this case. And he's ordered that Major Foy Van Lee not be allowed in this country. So she says, my hands are tied. I can't do anything officially. But she says, I think I can take you to, I can lead you to somebody that can do it, get the job done. And I said, who would that be? And believe it or not, Melody, the only people that have really helped me in this war against the evil in government have been women. They're the only same ones that seem to have the guts. So she gave me the name of Dr. Judith Ledinsky. And I called Dr. Ledinsky, who happened to be the chairperson of the scientific relations committee between the United States and Vietnam. And her job was to improve relations through the scientific mission with Vietnam. And I told her, I said, you realize that you'll be going up against Henry Kissinger and the CIA. And she says, I am not worried. And I gave her all the information, where to locate Major Foy Van Lee and everything. And she, because I had written to him, finally, after getting information from his nephew. She went over there, and it took a year in total for her to arrange everything. But she met with Major Foy Van Lee and his wife, and arranged for him and his wife and four children to come to the United States. They are now in Wichita, Kansas, and all U.S. citizens. But that's the kind of action that's been taken to try and keep the secrecy of illegal operation that's in my book from getting public. Because somebody asked me the other day, well, why would the CIA not want Major Foy Van Lee in this country? And I said, well, he is the only living person other than CIA who can stand up before Congress. And he was willing to then. Not now, he's getting too old now. He's willing to stand up before Congress and tell that the truth of what I wrote in the book is the truth. That is the truth about the CIA coming to my camp and asking us to kill Prince Sihanouk. They didn't want that witness there. Now, oddly enough, we used his witness in court to defend my publisher and myself. We used his letter, which proved that that was a fact. Also, we used Martha Ray's introduction, her foreword to the book, as testimony, because I have a signed copy for a computer printout of the foreword just after she'd written it and sent it to me. She's dead now, of course. Believe it or not, Melody, and you'd be upset about this, there's another brave woman, Martha Ray. The special forces tried to crucify Martha Ray in court because she had backed me in her foreword on the truth of my book. And they even accused her of being illiterate. And this really made an old-time friend of Martha Ray's really mad, and she sent me a copy of a book that Martha Ray had written. She'd written introductions to two different books besides mine, and she wrote the foreword to. And I proved in court that she could read and write and that was the truth in that foreword. And I tell you, I think that upset the jury as much as anything when they tried to crucify a lady who was really well-respected by every military man that I've ever known. She is the only person ever to visit all the Green Beret camps in Vietnam. Even when she came into my camp, and you'll read this in the book, I ordered her not to land in the camp because there was enemy activity around the camp. And she ordered the chopper in anyway and got two 50-caliber slugs in that chopper coming into my camp just so she could sit and visit with us and tell jokes and for about 2 hours, I guess. But you know what she did the first thing she got off that airplane? The helicopter, and there's a picture of this in my book. She had her black nurse's bag with her, and she went into the dispensary and helped my medics to treat wounded before she would sit down with us in the mess area and have a cup of coffee or a drink of beer. What a woman she was.
Yeah, I saw the picture on your website.
Oh, good.
Yes. Want to give a little background on you? I mean, you get into that a little bit in some of the information that you'd sent me on your into the Special Forces.
I grew up in the, let me see, we got quite a bit of time. I was born in Detroit, Michigan. The day that I was born, which is the 10th minute of the 10th hour of the 10th day of the 10th month in 1933, was the day that my dad left my mother. And he left my mother with a 16-year-old girl in his arm going out the door. But in fact, he wouldn't even been there when I was born, except that my Aunt Magdalene, who's a tough sucker, she made sure that he was there because she thought that would change his mind and he'd stay with my mother. But he left. We lived in Detroit during the Depression for about 5 years, and then we moved to the south side of Chicago. And by the time I was 11 years old in Chicago, I had formed my own little gang. And at first I formed them to protect elderly women who were being robbed by high school gangs when they came out of the store, grocery store. And we used Indian tactics. In fact, we used to go up in the top of the theater building. It's called the Ken Theater, K-E-N, on 47th Street in Southside Chicago. And we'd watch the movie through the vent up on the roof. We couldn't hear much of anything, but we could watch. Most of them were Western movies. And I taught my little gang of six men, boys, all 11 or 12, how to use Indian tactics. And we started ambushing that high school gang, and we beat them every time. But then, you know, when you get a gang going, and then you say you want to go rob a drugstore of candy or something like that, and you get involved in something like that. So we weren't doing all good, but we did protect the women in the south side of Chicago in that area between 47th and 43rd Street, knew that they could go safely to the grocery store and make it home without losing their groceries. I've always been fussy about protecting women. When you'll read in the book that the first law that I established in my area, because remember, this was an independent command, so once I left Colonel Tuttle's office, I was in charge, and there was nobody could tell me anything to do until I left my camp. And the first order that I put out was that if any man was caught raping or molesting a woman in all of Anfu, 64,000 Buddhist Wahaos lived, that he would be executed, he'd die within 24 hours. One day, shortly thereafter, two of my strikers, we called them, our indigenous fighters, two of our strikers were walking down the lane in the district in Anfu, and they heard this scream from a woman inside this little house, which happened to be the house of one of my other strikers who was out on the line, out of ambush. And there was a man raping this woman. They went in and they separated the man and the woman and gave her time to get cleaned up, and they brought him into camp. And this is what happened. As soon as he got into camp with the lady right there that he had raped, I called for volunteers to beat him to death. And I got four NCOs, sergeants, Vietnamese, who came forward, and they beat that man to death right there on the spot. And let me tell you, like Major Foy Van Lee, I think, said it best. He said the next time he went to Saigon, he was told that Anfu is the safest place in all of Vietnam for a woman. And that's the way I liked it. Now, after we left Well, when I was running the gang in Chicago, the high school gang got rifles. Now, you know, you can't hardly fight a rifle without some kind of weapon yourself. So me and my boys, we made homemade crossbows. And we'd get an ambush on top of a building or something, and we fired down on these boys, this high school gang that had been robbing the women. And we'd use crossbows, which were very silent. They couldn't even tell exactly where they were coming from. And we won every single ambush, and I never had, not a one of my gang was ever hit. When my mother found out that I had a homemade crossbow hidden under the stairs of our house in Chicago, that's when she decided to move out in the country. Now, up until that very day, believe it or not, and I know this is not easy to believe, Al Capone was one of my heroes. Because in the south side of Chicago, Al Capone was remembered mostly, he was in prison by the time I was there. He was known as a man who would go out and help the poor. He'd actually stand on a street corner and give dollar bills to poor people in 1939, for example. So we moved out in the country, and I went to work for Daniel T. Walker on a 2,500-acre cattle and pig farm. And sitting there at the table eating with the family, I lived right with the family, I was learning all kinds of good things about people like General Patton and General MacArthur and even Field Marshal Montgomery, and all of a sudden there was no more Al Capone as being my hero. It was American military leaders and some foreign military leaders too. And we left Mokena, Illinois, is where I was when I worked on his farm. We used to ride a bicycle quite a ways to get to his house until he asked me to just move right in with him. But after that, my mother remarried when I was 15 and bought a 100-acre farm outside of Ithaca, New York. And in June of 1952, when I was 18 and a half, that's when I volunteered for the United States Army. And it was easy for me to get indoctrinated as a Green Beret because of my background with my own little gang in Chicago. I mean, the rules that we followed were my rules as a gang leader. The rules that you follow when you're in special forces on an independent operation are your rules. And all you do is hope and pray that what you're doing is good for the job that you have. And I think people reading my book will see the Lord help me there to do a good job with the Vietnamese people. I love those Vietnamese people. We really let them down. I feel so bad that we betrayed the South Vietnamese.
You know, I've been in the last 3 or 4 years, I've been doing quite a bit of research on anywhere from the CIA to some of these other aspects that you're talking about. And it seems to be real evident that there's a lot of mixed messages. And I'm hearing the same thing in your statements when you talk about being upset that, you know, we're supporting the enemy. And at the same, I get lost in where the loyalties lie. Can you explain that a little bit to me?
Where do you feel the loyalties?
Well, I mean, like, you didn't seem to have a problem if the was it Pitzer? If he would have been over out of the country, would that have made a difference as to whether you would have taken that assignment?
Well, I would definitely have taken it. You know, it's mm-hmm. just like any other possible assignment that I may have took part in, as long as it was overseas. It didn't bother me any. Now, the day that I got saved, then all of a sudden, those things, I recognized that I could do something about the evil of those things. You know, they talk about brainwashing. I think when I volunteered to be a Green Beret, the fact that I was able to live with myself and to stay with the Green Berets when I learned without any doubt that it was our government that had killed President Kennedy, who was my hero at the time, why I didn't leave the Green Berets at that time is because by that time they had convinced me, as they had every other officer that was going through training. And by the way, that's the toughest training in the United States Army. It's the only training that I know of, okay, that officers don't automatically graduate. Normally, an officer goes into training, he graduates come hell or high water. In Special Forces, we started out with 32 men in my class, and I think we graduated 12 or 16 or something like that. Not one major or lieutenant colonel could get through the part about giving each other torture in our torture training. I don't know. I'll have to send you a copy of my article on torture training, which I've sent to Congress, and they don't seem to care. But we even used electricity on each other in the classroom to see how that works. Not one field grade officer would allow that to happen to them. It's only us captains and senior first lieutenants, because that's all there was left in the class, that graduated, but we were all willing to not only torture one another, but to accept it as one of the students learning about the value of torture and interrogation. Now, right now, I would not allow that at all, nor waterboarding, nor any of that. See, I used one specific thing when I tortured, I think, that helped me to get nothing but the truth from the individual I was torturing. Because that's the important thing, is to get the truth. And, you know, we were taught, you know, if you get caught and they start to torture you, you could either take the pill that you got to kill yourself, or you could just tell them what you think they want to know. And I made sure, I very seldom actually did much interrogation myself. My executive officer did almost all the interrogation. The only ones I did really was four women that we'd captured, four Viet Cong spies. And they had killed a woman and a baby on our side of the border, one of my strikers' wives and daughter. And when I asked Lieutenant Strait to interrogate them and find out, you know, where they're coming from and what was the enemy doing over there inside of Cambodia, he told me, he says, "But they're women, sir." In fact, that's the title of that chapter in the book, "But They're Women, Sir." So I interrogated them. But just like when I taught people, I told each one of those women before I gave them the first little bit of juice in the interrogation, and I know I speak of that rather flittingly right now, but right now I'm just telling you the truth about what happened then. I would tell them through the interpreter, and always through an interpreter because I don't understand Vietnamese that good or speak it good. I tell the interpreter, tell them that I want nothing but the truth from them. And if I find that they're just giving me information so they won't get tortured, then I'll kill them. Simple as that. If I had any indication whatsoever that they were not telling me the truth, even if I had to find it out the next day, they'd be dead meat.
Wouldn't they be jeopardized the same way on the, you know, with who they were loyal to?
Well, in their case, it turned out to be that way because they gave me some good information. And then what I did, I mean, you talk about something that's not fair. Of course, they were the enemy, and they'd killed a woman and a child. I gave them new black pajamas to wear that had been all cleaned up and everything. But inside of each pair of black pajamas, very secretly, we put in there a label that would identify it as being from us. And we had them free to roam around our area with guards watching them to make sure they didn't go across the border. And I did that so that the enemy, who were watching us all the time, when we were right on the border canal in Con Binh, Vietnam, that they would think that they'd become double agents. So then when we released them to go across the bridge into Cambodia, back to where they'd come from, within 2 days, I think it was, and I tell exactly what it is in the book, I believe, we found all four of them in the canal, floating, dead, with their tongues cut out, which is what the enemy would do to double agents.
So they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
Well, that's what they get for being in that kind of business.
Well, did some of them not have any choice? I mean, if they were invaded
They were invading our area. We weren't invading theirs.
Okay, all right.
This was all, what they did evil in killing that woman and child was inside Vietnam.
Okay.
My area.
Okay, but I pick up that you have some, you know, you had some, what do I want to say, the term, ethics of your own.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And yet, what I'm coming across in some of these, I'm beginning to wonder if there's much ethics in some of the people that are running our country or working within these some of these military jobs. I mean, it seems like, you know, you can't trust anyone.
That's about it.
Okay, and that seems to be your message.
Excuse me?
And that seems to be your message.
Right.
Okay.
I'm on the outside now trying to report what's going wrong on the inside. I've collected all this information on aiding the enemy all the way up through General Schwarzkopf, through General Tommy Franks. I talked to him personally when he was running the war in Iraq, and I asked him, point blank, well, I told him we just had a support the troop rally here in Casanova, and I asked him what were the two things that bothered him the most about the war, and he had to run, so he turned me over to this lieutenant colonel who I named in an article I wrote about this, and the information I gave to the officials that I've tried to get this straightened out. But he admitted, his aide did, the colonel, lieutenant colonel, that the two things that bothered him the most was, one, that he didn't believe that any of those people who had helped Rumsfeld put together the strategy for that invasion had ever been in combat. And secondly, that he'd only got half the people that he wanted. So I was so happy just hearing that they admitted that, and I published it and all. And then General Franks writes his book after he retires. And he completely dispels everything that he'd said that I'd reported on, everything that his colonel has said. He said that he enjoyed working with Rumsfeld and planning the invasion or the attack in Iraq, that he'd got all the forces that he'd asked for. And in fact, the colonel admitted, just like I'd been trained, when you go in and you take an area, you take enough troops to take over that area and provide a kind of a military government until they can establish their own. And he didn't take anybody to do that when he went into Iraq.
Well, that's the thing about, you know, all these oaths and secrecy and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. that you guys have to swear to, and then you have to watch all this stabbing in the back.
It's terrible. Why don't we do something about it? And I started to tell you, I've got all this information together, and I sent it to the commanding general of the U.S. Special Operations Command, which commands the Special Forces, the Rangers, the SEAL teams, all of them, commanding general of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, the War College, where I had served, that was my last service in the Army, and to the superintendent of West Point. the only response I've even gotten. And what I did, I wrote them asking that they demand that Congress pass a law where we could not aid the enemy and that we could not ever send people to kill our own people. Only one that answered was the admiral in charge of the Special Operations Command down in Florida, and his response was that he had not gotten the book that I sent him, even though I've got proof from the postal office that he did get it, and that he didn't get the previous letters, even though his staff has told me that he did get those letters. So I sent this information in to my senators and congressmen, and everybody is so afraid, and this is all I can assume, Melody, is so afraid of the CIA that they do not want to get involved.
Well, I don't know how anybody can trust anybody.
That's right.
And it doesn't appear...
There's one man that I'll trust with all my life, and that's this one other Green Beret in Syracuse, New York, that's willing to go to Congress with me, or Dennis David is willing to go. And, you know, we're all getting old, too. And pretty soon we won't be able to go, much less, we'll be willing but not able to go. But why won't they call us before Congress when I've given them absolute proof of the fact that we're aiding the enemy, and still are?
Because they would probably have to admit it, and they don't want to, they probably want to write a book like your Franks and go away being a hero.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he got a plus job, got all kinds of money when he retired. It's tough. And it's terrible that we even have to admit that there's such a system. But people have got to know. Why would Chris Milligan and I go, knowing that it would cost us a lot of money, we didn't know how much exactly, it was $152,000, all we had to do, and they called and got us both on the phone, said all I had to do was write a letter stating that Expendable Elite was fiction based on fact,
mm-hmm.
So that anything in there could be fiction, anything in there could be fact, but you couldn't prove either one, right? And they'd be off the hook on, the part that they sent people to kill me and my men, that was fiction. I refused to do it. My publisher stuck with me. And we won in court. That's the key. But our government won't do anything with that. William Pepper proved in court in Memphis, Tennessee, that Dr. Martin Luther King was killed. 70% of the conspiracy involved, how did they word it? Our government was 70% involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. I provided some of the evidence to William Pepper that proved gun running that was going on from Vietnam to Thailand to the United States to the Black Panthers as part of the overall program that General Yarbrough, as Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence of the United States Army, put together that would result in the death of Martin Luther King. Two teams of special forces were called up to active duty from a reserve, 20th Reserve Special Forces. The two men that, as I have, brought out the truth in that, they were actually involved in tailing Dr. King with orders that if the shooter missed, they were to shoot and kill Dr. King. They're hiding out in South America under assumed names
because
they're afraid to be here in the United States.
I was always under the impression that it was the FBI that was involved with that as well.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Do you
Interesting that in the Omaha building, there was a federal building that was blown up,
uh-huh.
And I don't think this has ever been reported that I know of, except that I know it, is that... why were the FBI offices completely...
Okay, now you're talking about the Murrah building.
Right.
Okay.
Why were the FBI offices vacant at the the time that that blew up.
Well, I've heard similar situations with the FBI being involved with it, too.
I know for a fact that John F. Kennedy was killed by our government. I know for a fact that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed by our government. I don't know about Bobby Kennedy. I know that he had gone after the mafia, so I'm sure that they weren't too happy with him, nor was the CIA, because of their tie-in with the mafia. But I don't know about those. But these other two I know about specifically. Mm-hmm. And I don't worry about them coming after me because the Lord protects me. You know, I had an FBI agent come to my office in Ithaca, New York, and I had turned in a report to him about the involvement of the Bush family in a billion-dollar bank scam out in Texas. And I gave him the names thinking I could trust the FBI of people who were willing to go to court to testify or to the FBI. And I gave him all that information. In about 2 weeks, he came back to my office, and he said that he'd like me to never tell anybody that had ever even talked to him about this billion-dollar scam. Turns out that three of the four people that I'd given him names to that were willing to testify were dead within 2 weeks of my giving them those names.
Oh, boy.
And the other one, it was a lady who was bankrupted and scared to death, and she called me and just told me never to ever mention her name to anybody again. Well, and he looked at me, this is the FBI agent, and he said, aren't you worried that they will put a bomb under your car? Now, they was the CIA. That's who we were talking about. And I said, well, the thing you don't understand is the CIA does nothing of that on their own. They'll either use somebody like me, Special Forces, or Mafia. That's who does all their killing and their dirty work. And I said, anybody from the Mafia that was asked to come and get old Dangerous Dan, they'd know me, and they'd worry more about what I'd put under my car to keep them from putting a bomb under there. And actually what I was trying to say, and should have said it just outright, is the Lord Jesus Christ was protecting me. I wasn't worried about it at all. But they are even concerned, the FBI. You know, when I turned in the initial investigation request in Thailand about this gun running that ended up to be a part of the hit on Dr. King, the CID, the Military Criminal Investigation Division, and this was in the report. I've only got 1 minute here.
Yeah.
He said in the report, we can't actually do anything about this until you're back in the States. Otherwise, we'll all be dead. And I can cover this the next time we meet.
Okay, great. And I really appreciate you coming on. Do you have any closing comments or want to speak again about your book and your website?
Oh, please. If they want to get a copy of my book, 1-800-556-2012, and please ask for a signed copy. We don't mind the extra work involved in it for the same amount of money. And my website is expendableelite.com, and you can order the book right on the website, but you can't ask for it signed there. But you can read all the stuff about the trial and how we proved that my book is the truth. And I guess I'll be back with you in May, and I'll look forward to that. And perhaps we can get deeper into some of these things after you've had a chance to read the book.
Okay, that'd be great, and I look forward to it. And thank you again, Dan.
Oh, and by the way, I thank you for having the courage to have me on your program.
Well, this is the name of the program is Questing for Truth. Here,
amen. So. God bless you.
Okay, well, thank you.
Take care, Molly.
Uh-huh. Goodbye. This is Truth Quest, and this is KHEN. LP 106.9 Salida, and that we just had Colonel Dan Marvin, and coming up next is Joe Frank,